thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 18 for the last week of December 2007. The top stories of 2007. I'm Dan Cohen. We've reached the end of the year, our first year in podcasting, and I'm here with the usual suspects, Tom Scheinfeld. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Dan.
And Mills Kelly. Hi, Mills.
Hey, Dan.
And today we're going to have a special Digital Campus podcast. We're going to cover the top 10 digital campus stories for 2007. These are stories that we thought were the most important, that say something about the way that digital is having an impact on campuses, on universities, on libraries and museums as well. And we're going to dive right in with number 10, which is the digitization of books proceeds apace. Tom and Mills, I guess this was a year that we not only saw more universities join the Google Books program, but also the Open Content Alliance. And literally hundreds of thousands, indeed, probably over a million books were scanned in 2007, and I assume that's just going to increase. What will this mean for campuses and libraries in the future?
Well, I think that it means that an incredible problem is going to be generated, and that is, how are we going to cope with all of these books? I mean, it's wonderful in the sense that there are going to be so many books available to search easily, but it's really going to up the ante for developing tools to help people sort through the content in all of these books. So I think libraries are going to really have to figure that out to help students and scholars.
I agree with Mills. I think that the story here is more. I think that there was almost a rush this year. It started, I think, in 2006 and 2005, but there was a rush this year for every university to sign up with some either Open Content Alliance or Google or someone to start a massive digitization project. And I think a lot of it was sort of keeping up with the Joneses, and I don't know how much forethought was put into a lot of these digitization projects with regard to just the issues that, Mills identifies. How are scholars going to be able to cope with all this information? What are they going to do about long-term preservation and access? Those kinds of issues. I think it's great that we've got lots of books. I think we need to figure out what to do with them.
Yeah, I mean, this was the first year, and I think this is why it made our top 10, that, I heard from many colleagues and historians about, actually using Google Books. Interestingly, not the Open Content Alliance book, simply because I think people don't realize they're there, and there's not a good organization for them right now, except for the fact that, for instance, you can search through a lot of them through Microsoft's interface, their book search interface. But, people know Google Book Search is there. It's coming up now in, if you do a regular Google search now, this is one of the interesting things that happened in 2007. Google switched to what they call their universal search, so their default search actually searches all their services, including YouTube Now and Google Scholar and all these other things, or Google News. And one of the things it searches is Google Books. So you actually see a book title come up in their little box at the top. And so I think people realized, wow, there's actually these books out there. And, historians who are working in my field in Victorian history are noticing that, even some fairly rare Victorian books are now up there. And so it's getting used, as you said, but right now it's only at the stage where it's about access. It's about, proofreading your book at 3 a.m. wanting to check a quote. And so, you go on Google Books, find the book, page through it, find the quotation and make sure you've transcribed it accurately. It's at that stage. It's not at the stage where we're doing any kind of sophisticated digital research on it. And I think this is something that we'll look at for 2008 is maybe the year where when you've got a lot of this stuff, especially in an open fashion at the Open Content Alliance, that you might be able to do some very interesting kinds of research. Moving on to number 9, we had two major operating systems launching this year. Of course, Vista at the beginning of the year, and then Leopard at the end of the year, the Mac operating system. Did this have any impact, or I guess we spoke about this on prior podcasts, but it seemed like at least Vista didn't seem to go very far. Has Leopard done anything? Have either one of these made a difference?
I'm not sure that either of them have made a difference. I don't think many campuses have switched over in any wholesale way to either Vista or Leopard. I think part these were both in a way non-stories, and I think to some extent it reflects the maturity of the operating system now. The kind of visual Windows style operating system is pretty mature now, and all of these. It seems like these recent upgrades were really, you know, maybe they changed the look of things a little bit. Maybe things are a little shinier and flashier, a few new features here and there. But essentially the way things work is just about the same in both Leopard and in Vista. And so I think we may be seeing the kind of maturity of the operating system. And I think the big story may be in 2008 is that may provide an opening for some open source competitors like Ubuntu, Linux, because with the feature set kind of standardized, you can then there's room for some competitors. So I think maybe that's one thing to look out for in next year.
Right. I mean, we probably should have added to this the rise of Ubuntu in the year. I mean, it's something that, you know, I've seen a few people at the Center for History and New Media, where we all work. And, you know, a few people have sort of switched over to Ubuntu. I mean, it looks fine. It does everything that the other operating systems do, or most of the things. And so it's a viable operating system. I think, you know, mainstream, it's still going to be either Mac or PC. But I think you're right. I mean, maybe this is sort of the last major cycle of release, and certainly for the operating systems, and much more is going to be happening in a web environment or a networked environment from here on out, that, you know, what are the new innovations that really can be added? And for campuses and museums and libraries, you know, what is the compelling upgrade? I mean, XP, you know, does everything you kind of need to do to, let's say, run a library catalog in your library clusters, let's say. And so, you know, it's not clear what the sort of marginal utility of these new operating systems are, although they certainly look nice and thus made our top 10 at number 9. Number 8. Privacy concerns simmer. Boy, we've talked a lot about privacy concerns on the podcast this year. Indeed, just last week we talked about Ask.com, one of the lesser-known search engines, adding a Ask Eraser. And I have a feeling we're going to be talking about privacy farther down the count later in the podcast. But are we the only three people who care about privacy here, Hills and Tom?
Well, I think we might be three of about 12. There are clearly some people who are very worried about these issues, but certainly from my experience, my students aren't part of that group that is remotely concerned about internet privacy. They pretend as though it just doesn't exist and blithely provide all sorts of information online. So I'm not sure I'm being facetious about only 12, but I think it's a bigger issue than a lot of people do.
Yeah, I mean, I think our conclusion has been over the year that certainly campus administrations are really concerned with privacy and security, and students are exactly the opposite. So there's a strange tension where, there's been an increase in spending, I think, on these kinds of issues. I mean, for instance, at the George Mason campus, we got rid of social security numbers on a lot of things. There's more logons for things. There's all kinds of things, and also concerns about, you know, what personal information is being hosted on George Mason servers, and what can be found out through regular searches on George Mason sites. But meanwhile, you know, all of our students are giving away their, Mills, as you point out, their birth date and everything you need to do a night, you know, to open a credit card in your name on Facebook and other places. So it's not entirely clear to me where the tension between those users and the administrations is going to go. But you think we'll be talking about privacy in a year, or will the assumption or presumption be you're giving it all away?
I think we're going to keep talking about it just because it's something that we actually care about.
Right.
But I think I'm not sure whether anybody's going to be listening.
Okay. Well, at number 7, it seems like more and more people have been listening to Wikipedia. And we decided number 7 really is that Wikipedia got respect in 2007. In fact, just recently, Jimmy Wales sort of reneged on something he had said earlier about students, you know, shouldn't use Wikipedia in the classroom or in their homework. And at the end of the year, just a few weeks ago, he said, well, maybe that's not true. Maybe it is something that's useful to use on campus. You know, Mills and Tom, I noticed that in our server logs, our very first podcast, which was about Wikipedia, it still gets an enormous number of listens every month, even 9 or 10 months later. Does it surprise you that Wikipedia has sort of gotten some kind of traction?
I don't think it surprises me. I mean, I think it's such a vast resource, and it's so available that I think it was bound to get attention. I think at the beginning of the year and last year, the concerns were really over how best to use it. I think it was this new technology that people needed to learn how to use it. And I think people are starting to calm down a little bit about it and starting to realize that, well, like anything out there, we need to teach our students how to use it and not just have this knee-jerk reaction of you know, we need to protect them entirely from it. And so I think, again, I think it's maybe a story of Wikipedia maturing more than anything really new happening. It's just, it's the user base is getting more comfortable with it, and the resources is maturing as a legitimate piece of cultural production in the out there on the web.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that the anxiety about it has gone down, and I mean, I think that there though will and or there are and will continue to be people who just simply say, "Forget it, you can't use that. It's bad because it's malleable." But as more and more content on the web in a whole variety of ways gets more malleable, I think people's comfort level with that will continue to increase.
Well, yeah, I guess the, you know, as they say, the imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. And I suppose 2007 was really a year of imitation. I mean, Larry Sanger, who was, you know, can take claim as being a co-founder of Wikipedia, really pushed forward with this Citizendium project that we discussed and, you know, which he wanted to be a kind of more scholarly or vetted version of Wikipedia. And they wrote, I think, about 3,000 articles in 2007. Of course, I mean, this is 1/100th or 1/1,000th of the number of articles available on Wikipedia. But the idea is that, you know, they'll only release an article when it's fully developed and vetted and considered to be accurate and so forth. You know, just in the last week, Google, which I believe had been supporting Wikipedia by providing free bandwidth for them, has launched this Knoll. I don't know where they get these names. They're awful. But KNOL, I guess it's short for knowledge. And the idea is that they're going to host a kind of, again, a competitor or imitator of Wikipedia that are going to be these, what they hope to be, canonical web pages for particular topics. So a scholar of, let's say, Victorian history could write the best web page on Victorian history. I'm not exactly sure what that would look like, but some kind of article that Google would host on their site. And again, the distinction here with Wikipedia being that it'll be a single author rather than multiple authors. And again, the idea is to get sort of a slightly more polished or finished look or prose than you get on Wikipedia. Are any of these going to succeed, or is Wikipedia the kind of, it's snowballing now and there's no way to kind of catch it?
Well, I think if one of them has a chance to succeed, Citizendium seems like kind of a boondoggle to me. I think it's like, Wikipedia with trying to vet Wikipedia. And I think Wikipedia, what makes Wikipedia Wikipedia is how big it is, and how many people participate. And I think because of that, it's impossible to vet. So I don't think a kind of vetted version of Wikipedia is really going to work. What I do think, though, could work with Noel is that you're going to have experts or even you know, people who call themselves experts writing these articles on certain topics. And what's interesting about it is they're allowing multiple articles on the same topic. And so
yeah, that is interesting.
There could be two different articles on Albert Einstein, or 10 of them. And it will be, and the ones which kind of rise to the top of the search results are the ones that are most used, most interesting, that receive the most critical feedback. And I'm not exactly sure how they're going to determine that. But and so instead of just allowing it, it's whereas Wikipedia allows people to change the article and change the search results and things just by who's been there most recently, this is going to be determined. You know, there's going to be almost like a self election of these articles of different articles on the same topic. And so I think that's kind of a different model, and I'll be really interested to see where it goes.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say I'm a little bit skeptical about this, but, you know, what you raised is that you brought up the question of what comes to the top of search results. And one of the reasons Wikipedia is in our top 10 at number 7 is that, you know, boy, every time you search now, you'll end up with a Wikipedia article near the top, if not at the top. You can do a bunch of searches, for instance, for history topics, and Wikipedia is in the top 10 on the Google search. You know, it's, you know, there's so many links to Wikipedia pages, which gets factored into, very highly into how something ranks, in Google. They're also search engine optimized, as it's called, or SEO'd, meaning that, Wikipedia pages have, you know, they're keyword rich right in the URL. So if an article is on Abraham Lincoln, it's wikipedia.org/wiki/Abraham Lincoln. And which is a really good URL for Google to read, and they take account of words that are right in the URL itself. So Wikipedia has ended up to be a very effective sort of search engine optimized site, and with lots of people linking to it, and again, keyword rich, and also covering so much, that they're getting an enormous amount of traffic. I can't remember what the latest numbers were, but I think it was something like 2.5 billion page views a month. And Google just must be looking at that and wondering, you know, well, A, why they don't put Google AdSense on their pages and make millions of dollars a year, which, of course, is not the goal of the project. But also thinking, you know, I wonder if we could create some kind of service that would also have highly ranked pages. And, you know, what's tough here at the end of the day is, well, wait a second, they're the dominant search engine. And they're also going to be a content provider. And I think as many commentators have said, I mean, this is sort of a conflict of interest. They're supposed to be, you know, their search results. We like Google because they give us good search results. And we assume they're not fiddled with in any way. But then you're going to have Google hosting content in the same way, frankly, that Yahoo hosts a lot of content that shows up in Yahoo's search engine.
And paying authors for that content.
Right. And so you would think, well, wait a second, don't they want these Noel pages to show up high in their search rank, you know, in their search engines? I think there's going to be some shakeout on this. I think as a lot of people said, it's sort of crossed some line here that I think is making a lot of people feel uncomfortable. But it does seem like a very attractive prospect if you are an expert on something to create a page, you know, that you could make a considerable amount of AdSense money on. Seems like an interesting idea. So I don't know, though. I'm still wondering if this is one of those projects, one of many, many projects that Google just sort of throws out there in a half-baked way and see if something happens. I mean, you can look through all of Google's projects, Google Base and Google Pages and all these things that really they haven't taken off. And so I just wonder about this, whether it will work. But I guess we will see in 2008. At number 6, we have something that's very close to our heart, and that is that really we saw 2007 as the year in which digital humanities started to take off. I mean, just this week I looked at the sessions at the Modern Language Association, and their convention is in Chicago next week, December 27th through 30th. And helpfully, the Association for Computers and the Humanities just compiled a list of sessions with digital humanities talks at the 2007 MLA convention, and there are well over 50 sessions this year on digital humanities. In fact, there's at certain time slots, there's three or four sessions that you could go to that have something to do with digital humanities. And of course, 2007 was also the year where there were all these new initiatives from NEH and IMLS, the Institute for Museum and Library Services, government bodies that are now funding initiatives in digital humanities. There are digital humanities grants from ACLS and other organizations. So really, I think things have started to take off quite a bit, and I think we'll see more and more faculty and students getting interested in digital humanities. Although, are we too inside? Is this insider info here? I mean, inside stuff that we're just in digital humanities, so we think that this is happening, or is this something real?
I think it's something real, because I think that the NEH does provide a certain kind of leadership quality, in the sense that other foundations, other granting organizations look to see what the NEH is doing and then wonder whether they should be doing similar kinds of things. And so I think this signals the wider availability of funding for digital humanities projects, rather than us, you know, in the old days we used to have to try to slip things, webbish things, into more conventional proposals. Now the money's really specifically for digital humanities, and I think that signals a kind of legitimization of digital humanities work too.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Tom, what do you make of this?
Obviously, I'm very pleased about it, and I do think it is something real. I think we'll see a true legitimization of digital humanities work, though, when these projects, and I'm very pleased about these targeted projects, targeted funds for digital humanities work, but I think we'll see a true legitimization of digital humanities work when these projects in turn go away, and that digital humanities just becomes the norm, and all the traditional programs, public programs and research and development programs and all these other programs coming out of the major funding bodies, just treat digital work as run of the mill, as something that that obviously it fits under our funding guidelines. That's when I think we'll see the true test. But I do think it's a great development, and I encourage listeners to look at the especially the NEH Digital Humanities Initiative, because I think there's an awful lot there, a lot of new programs this year that people probably haven't seen before, and a lot of new opportunities to do some good work.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Tom. When I was at the Coalition for Networked Information meeting a couple of weeks ago, and I was on a panel that was on digital humanities centers, and someone from the audience, I think, made that exact point, or raised this question of, does it make sense for there to be digital humanities centers on campuses that also have humanities centers, as many colleges and universities do have indeed? And I thought it was a great point, and my response was exactly yours, that, I think ultimately humanities centers will be doing digital work. It's just currently it's bifurcated into digital humanities centers and humanities centers. But ultimately we want to see this, folded back and a seamless part of the humanities, as it must become, because so many things are going digital, and research will absolutely have to become digital. And I think scholarly communications will become digital as well. So, but it's great to see this real infusion of funding. And like Tom, I agree that everyone should check out the guidelines for applying to NEH for funds in this area, as well as other foundations, private and public. At number five, we have web applications move onto campus. And here we thought about really the big launch of Google Docs, and also the fact that Gmail is making inroads into campuses. I mean, just last week, Arizona State University, which has taken adopted Gmail as their campus mail. So they've thrown out their entire internal email system, and they came out with a report saying that they saved $500,000 this year and expect to save $500,000 in subsequent years as well. I mean, this is an incredible amount of money that these universities are saving. And you could imagine the same going on if campuses, put down their very expensive Microsoft Office licenses and, go with some of these free, it doesn't necessarily have to be Google Docs, but Zoho or one of these other web applications that are totally free and have most of the functionality that students and faculty need, you can imagine a huge amount of savings. Is this a trend that's going to continue? Do you think Arizona State's out in the forefront and others will adopt these web apps and web email as opposed to the expensive on-campus solutions they've previously had?
I think definitely. I mean, I think institutions are going to start to see these kind of basic services. You know, once upon a time, email was, this new thing, and it was this new exciting thing, and you had to sort of do it yourself. But I think, email has really been, and especially with things like Gmail and Yahoo's new mail, where you have unlimited storage and other systems, email's really become commoditized. And I think there are other probably, and I can't think of them right off the top of my head, but there are other services, maybe document storage and things like that, are becoming commoditized. And I think it's only going to make sense for campuses to kind of outsource some of that work in the same way that they outsource the parking services. I'm sitting here looking out my window at a parking lot, and the university doesn't run the parking lot. They have a parking service that runs it. They're going to do the same thing with email and with other kind of very basic tech services.
Given how unbelievably bad our parking services is, though, don't use that as your example when you're trying to convince people.
I'm not saying it's a good thing,
I'm going to be the contrarian on this one, because I really think that very few state universities are going to go the way that Arizona State went, because they're so wedded to the kind of silo model of, you have to have an entire support structure for any technology implementation on campus. And, if people are going to have email, then we have to have 7 or 8 people working here who can support the email system for the university. And I mean, that's where the Arizona State saved all the money, is in personnel costs, I'm quite
sure.
Sure,
right.
But I think universities are so bound up in this kind of we have to have a support bureaucracy model that I'm going to be really surprised if there is a kind of wholesale move in the direction of these free applications, despite the obvious cost savings and really improvement in service, because like Gmail is so much better than the email system that the university offers here. But I just don't see it.
Haven't people realized that support network or that support infrastructure is just so bad? I mean, I think at most big institutions like this, it's the support network is completely broken, and people don't use it because they know they're not really going to get any help. I mean, I know I don't call the support hotline because I know I'm just not going to really get any help. They're gonna like ask me if have rebooted my computer or something like that. That's about as far as the support goes. And so maybe people will move on. But I do think you're right, Mills, that it is probably the big roadblock to the adoption of these kinds of things.
Well, I mean, and I would say the roadblock is really, it's the professors. I mean, we're the problem, right? Because all the students coming in, I can't imagine any student is coming in at this point without probably an email address that they've been using for 10 years, and a service that they feel comfortable, probably Gmail, but I still see a lot of people using Yahoo's mail and Hotmail as well. And they don't need any support for their email. And I'm seeing more and more students who are using Google Docs. And, it's just like, yeah, I just need to write some text. Here's something that does it for me. I don't need Word. At some point, doesn't somebody have to look at the stats for the actual use of these systems and see that they're declining for certain groups of the, and they don't need the number of hard drives and bandwidth, et cetera, because it's sort of being outsourced de facto?
Well, and I'm actually starting next semester requiring my students to use Google Docs. So, because it's just so much easier than having them email me their papers in, you know, one of five different formats that I may or may not be able to access. So if they just put them up in Google Docs, we're all set.
Okay. Well, we'll have to place bets on that one and see where we are at the end of 2008. While web apps were moving on campus, something else interesting happened at number four, which is that lectures were moving off campus. We discussed this quite a bit this year, and Mills, I think you were our biggest proponent of this, but we saw really an expansion of the use of podcasting. iTunes U really took off. Indeed, just a couple of days ago, the New York Times, on the front page of the New York Times, had an article on a professor at MIT whose physics lectures are viewed by millions of people worldwide. He's now this web celebrity because of his lectures. And the use of YouTube as well. You know, I think these video and audio sources and the ability to stream this stuff all around the world and bring it into the classroom, take it out of the classroom, has really opened up the classroom and made it accessible. And also, Mills, as you talked about in one of our podcasts, you know, the ability to use video from YouTube has been really helpful. Again, is this a trend? I mean, do you think you'll see more classrooms opening up, more lectures going online? Or will some universities be leery about giving away their precious lectures and opening up the work of their professors?
I have to say, I'm just sitting here laughing to myself as you were talking about this, because in 2000, I published something on the AHA website, a course portfolio in which I opened up my classroom for inspection. But the way I opened it up was just by writing a narrative about what happened in my class and an analysis of what happened and providing examples of student work and things like that. And I got to tell you, I got so much hate mail from that, people who are just seriously pissed off at me for exposing my teaching to public view because they believed it was going to set a precedent that they were then going to be expected to let people see what was happening in their classrooms. I mean, I was completely caught off guard by this. I never expected that people would be really mad at me about that. I mean, for every complimentary email I got, I probably got three really nasty emails from people. And, this is a horrible precedent. And so to see, you know, professors becoming YouTube celebrities to me is just so ironic. but I think in terms of higher education, I think that this is going to be one of the most positive developments of the decade because it does make it possible for anyone. I mean, if you're broadcasting your class, whether a podcast or a video or YouTube or however you're doing it, it makes it possible for anyone who's interested in your subject to then learn more about it and maybe learn more about what you're interested in. And it makes the diversification of education so much more possible. And I have to say, and this is what I got all the hate mail about, it introduces a certain level of accountability about what happens in the classroom because what happens in the classroom is not always good.
Well, I think that's what people are afraid of is the accountability. I mean, I hope it takes off because I would like to see, and this is especially true in the humanities, and maybe most of all in history in our discipline. There's this culture of secrecy around what scholars do and how, you know, you're not supposed to, everybody's worried about someone stealing their idea or publishing on the same topic before they get around to it. And it really is absurd. It makes no sense when we're supposed to be educators. We're supposed to be purveyors of knowledge. We're supposed to be spreading knowledge rather than protecting knowledge. And so I hope even, you know, and there's some people who are in the forefront of this, and I'd put Mills in that camp. I hope that it starts to break down some of that culture of secrecy in academia that I think is really, it's really insidious. It's really counter to what we are supposed to stand for. Let's hope that it works.
And I got to say, for the people who express these concerns about my own academic freedom and all of that, all I can say is get over yourself.
Well, I'm going to be slightly contrarian on this. I think the trend here is going to be much like what Yale did when they launched Open Yale courses or Yale Open courses. I think it's at open.yale.edu, I believe. But they only put up 7 courses, and I looked at the courses, and I know a lot of the professors at Yale, and these are the best people at Yale. I mean, the best lecturers at Yale. So in political science, they have the intro course from Stephen Smith, who I've taught with, and he's terrific. He's funny. He's approachable. And he's brilliant. And so I think this is much like when we played the Berkeley YouTube channel on this podcast. I think this is a great PR move for universities. And I think they're going to end up not opening it up. I think most professors' stuff will remain locked up, but they're gonna put their superstars out there on the web and use this as a marketing tool. But I hope both of you are right on this. At number 3, we switch gears quite a bit and mention that Second Life, the virtual world, has beckoned. And, we were just looking at the traffic monitor at compete.com, where you can look at traffic to various sites. And if you look at secondlife.com, its traffic really did surge this year, and indeed, we noticed that. I think, as one of you put it before we started podcasting today, if you want to get a paper or a grant, you can put Second Life in the title, and it will really help out quite a bit. It does seem like libraries and museums certainly wanted to jump into Second Life this year, and a lot of academics took the jump. The three of us have been skeptics here. Have either of you changed your mind over the year?
Not in the slightest.
Yeah, me neither.
And for the reason that I said before, which is that Second Life is just not going to be a platform for educational endeavor, because it is increasingly a platform for what we might loosely call adult activities. And, people having virtual sex in back rooms of
right.
Second Life. And and so certainly K-12 education can't in any way be associated with that. So MacArthur's just flushing hundreds of thousands of dollars down the toilet by supporting stuff related to Second Life. And because no high school is going to allow its kids to go, no public high school is going to be allowing people to do that over the long term, their kids to go into Second
but
Life.
Can you create some kind of walled off space in Second Life?
Yeah, there's tons of walled off space, but so what? I mean, that doesn't mean that people on one side of the wall don't say to the kids from your high school on the other side of the wall, "Hey, kid, you want to come in and have some fun?" It's just from the standpoint of public education, K-12 education, Second Life is over. I mean, it may happen briefly, but then there's going to be the first scandal, and it's going to be totally over. The first lawsuit from a parent, forget it. It'll never happen again. There may be some use for Second Life in higher education, but for K-12 education, which is where a lot of the money seems to be drifting, I think it's a total loser.
I think it's a good idea whose time hasn't come yet. I think it's an immature technology.
I would agree.
I think eventually there probably will be something like the metaverse, from Snow Crash. But I think Second Life is not it. I think it's the entry costs are too high to do anything really interesting in Second Life. I think that it has all of the problems of an immature technology, as with the bad characters that Mills has just talked about. I think you had the same thing in the video industry, that the first video stores, and we have a colleague, Josh Greenberg, who has looked at this. A lot of the first video stores made most of their money on porn, and video stores were not necessarily in the very early days the nicest places to frequent. As the technology matures, I think there will be, some sorting out of those issues. I think the entry costs will be lowered, so that, you can do something really compelling on your own without a major grant from MacArthur. I think there are people doing some compelling things, but I think it's not quite there. And I think, we may see in 5 or 10 years a new company or a new platform, a new Second Life that will meet the promise that everybody sort of hopes for it today. But I think we're not quite there yet.
Yeah, I feel like this has been a repetitive story. I mean, I even remember being in college in the late 80s that the virtual world stuff was starting to happen then too. And there have been sort of every 5 years some virtual world that, you know, people said, okay, this is it. There's going to, you know, this is changing the way that, you know, we might be able to do teaching and, you know, create learning modules or have historical sites in this world. And it doesn't seem to happen. But for some reason, Second Life, it has gotten traction this year. And, I still wonder, maybe the three of us are missing something here.
I think just one last note on this. I think one of the things about Second Life that I think, and Dan, as you say, all of these virtual worlds that they don't quite get is that what's attractive about technology and attractive about the internet is the extent to which it connects with real life. And so I think the sites, and we're going to talk about some, I think, in a minute, that do really well are not the sites that create a different world. They're sites that augment or supplement the real world.
Right, right.
And I think that's maybe why these virtual worlds never quite get there.
Okay. Well, we are getting close to the top here. And at number two, those who've been following the Digital Campus saga on this year will know and probably be surprised that this is not number one, considering yours truly and what happened over the summer. Well, iPhone makes an impact. Certainly a big story this year. I guess really iPhone, Tom and Mills, this is maybe a stand-in for us for... I think it really opened up people's eyes to the possibilities of what a cell phone could be. And we discussed this last week on the podcast that really we think 2008 will be the year in which the phone as a learning platform, as an educational platform, as a campus and library museum messaging platform is really going to take off. Surely we need to credit here Steve Jobs and the iPhone, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that the intuitiveness of the interface, the joy that's present in using the iPhone makes it something people really want to use, something people really want to do new things with. And I think that really opens it up. It's not so much that the technologies that the iPhone uses are new. I mean, touchscreens aren't new, and all of the little applications that the iPhone carries are not new. They've been on BlackBerries for years. But I think the whole package, I think, shows and just how pretty it is and how fun it is to use just shows people the possibilities. And I think it makes it very clear to people the possibilities of this mobile platform. And I think that, and as we said last week, I think 2008 is really going to be the year of the cell phone.
Yep, I have to agree. I mean, I think the key to the iPhone is that it's going to inspire so much imitation. And and so all of those kind of great things that Tom just mentioned will become fairly ubiquitous pretty quickly because the cell phone industry is nothing if not imitative. And so I think we're going to see handheld devices, which we used to call cell phones, being just more and more important. And so therefore opening up lots of possibilities for us.
Right. Well, I'm certainly in agreement. Having one sitting right by me here, it's calling out to have greater purpose.
Life?
I don't think it has changed my life, but it's made my life more enjoyable, and I appreciate it for that. No, I mean it has some things that I didn't realize I'd really like or love about it before I got it. The fact that and I think this is important for education, text on it looks really good. The number, the dots per inch, and the resolution you get on this screen. And there are other screens, as you said, Mills. I mean, there are handsets now coming out that have similar high quality. And I'd include, you know, we were disparaging ebooks, but I actually got a chance to look at a Sony 505 reader. And it has similar high quality text that finally, you know, you get a serif font like you have in books. So it's not, you know, one of these sans serif fonts like Verdana or Geneva like you'll see most often on a computer screen, but fonts that look like academic fonts or that look like the New York Times. And the quality of that is so good that you actually want to read on it. And I think getting good text on a phone and a high number of words per line and high number of lines per screen, and then also adding in all the things, Mills, that you've talked about, and Tom, you as well, about GPS and location-based activities, and accessing the web, and also being able to create applications for it. It's really an exciting possibility of now we've got something in our pocket, finally, that is so versatile that it's more compelling, I think, ultimately, than the computer, which sits on a desk or you have to schlep around because it's, you know, a laptop. Even though they've gotten lighter, it's still something big. You have to open it up like a clamshell. And here's something you can just, you know, pull out and have right in your hand. So I think the form factor is going to just make it more and more important. So, yes, iPhones. I noticed a lot at the Center for History and New Media end of the year party. A lot more people than I expected had iPhones, and I have a feeling the whole staff will by the end of 2008. Okay, I wish we had a drum roll. I need sound effects on my laptop. I guess we'll have to invest our digital campus budget in sound effects for 2008. But probably no surprise, at number one, Facebook takes over. My goodness, this Facebook, we just couldn't put it down, could we, Tom and Mills, this year? I guess it really was the most important story on campus, wasn't it? And probably it already was in 2005 and 2006 for all of our students. But it's for everybody else that puts it to the top of the list. Well, and also the fact that they added applications this year. Is that, Mills, what is your sense? Why did it take off? You were on it, I think, before I was. And Tom, I guess the two of us got on it soon thereafter. But what brought you to Facebook, and why do you think it topped our list this year, Mills?
Well, what brought me to it was the fact that that's where my students were, and so that was a way of connecting to my students in a fairly simple interface, and in a way of being in contact with them, especially because they use email less and less. So for me, that's really the reason I started doing it. And I think that really the big story is the opening up Facebook to third-party applications, because that's meant a big surge in popularity of the site, and certainly I think a lot more use, a lot more time spent at a Facebook screen, and I think it's also inspired educators to think that, well, there could be actually educational applications developed for this platform as well.
Yeah, this sort of ties into what I was saying about earlier about Second Life. I think the genius of Facebook is that it does a very good job of supplementing real world relationships. I mean, I think it allows you to extend those relationships sort of in time and in space. And so relationships that students have in the dorms can continue while they're home on holiday break, or they can continue relationships students have in and this is I think the potential for education, relationships students have in the classroom can extend when they leave the classroom, and that's I think the beauty and the potential of Facebook. I think we've also this year talked about a lot of the problems with Facebook as well, privacy concerns and Beacon and other things being probably first and foremost. But I think it really was the story of 2007, and it'll be interesting, I think, to see whether it maintains its momentum in 2008 or whether something overtakes it, either in the social networking arena or in some other area of digital campus technology, such as the cell phone.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about that really we were talking about these cycles of social networking sites. First it was Friendster, then it was MySpace, then it was Facebook. It seems to me like Facebook has a lot of momentum, but it's web momentum. And I think one of the big problems that they have right now is they're forcing you to go to their site. Theoretically they have RSS or feeds for some of their pieces, but nobody uses them. They're hard to find. They intentionally bury them. And I think something that might be more cell phone-ish, maybe even starts on the cell phone, and stays on the cell phone, that really isn't a web interface. And I know, of course, Facebook is desperately moving onto phone systems, and they have a really good iPhone app, for instance. But I think something that might be on the cell phone would have a really good chance. And you know, I assume this is the reason that Google bought Jaiku, J-A-I-K-U, which is another sort of Twitter or sort of mini feed of what you're doing, but also has the possibility for geolocation. It's something like that of knowing, oh, all your friends are near this place, let's go grab coffee. I think there's got to be some next generation of this that's more mobile. And
I think the important thing is there's got to be multiple points of entry. I think, you know, people want to be able to access these things and to interact with these products through IM. They want to use their, they want to be able to use email. They want to be able to use maybe a desktop app. In addition to the web. And I think Facebook right now, you know, they have some of these things, but the first point of entry and the main point of entry is this web page that you have to visit. So I think that's something to look for in the next year. And I think the other thing to look for in this space is possibly an open competitor to Facebook. I don't know if that will happen, but there is some movement in that direction with Google and a bunch of other services launching a kind of open application platform for open social for multiple social network platforms. And so if we could see that kind of ubiquity of interaction and an open platform, I think that really could help to kind of possibly knock Facebook off and have some real innovation in this area.
Well, that will have to wrap up this year's, our first annual end-of-the-year wrap-up of the top 10 stories. We hope this was fun and enjoyable for our audience, and we're looking forward to hearing from you again. You can reach us via email or via our website at digitalcampus.tv. Just one final editor's note, and really a note from all three of us that if we really thought about it, the top story of the year for us, of course, was unfortunately the passing away of Roy Rosenzweig, our friend and colleague at the Center for History and New Media. We think about him every day, and we know he would have enjoyed listening to the podcast and to looking forward to everything that comes in technology and the humanities in 2008. So we'll see you again in a couple of weeks on the podcast, and wish everyone a happy holidays and a best and happiest of New Year's.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself. Thank you.